We're looking for sunny skies and a high of 91 today in Phoenix. It's sunny and 81 at 11 o'clock.
This week, Governor Doug Ducey vetoed a few bills, including one that would have kept private for 60 days the identities of police officers involved in shootings. He also signed controversial abortion-related legislation. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll check in on the state capitol to hear about the impact of the governor's actions and whether they give us any insight on his leadership and philosophies. Plus, many are concerned that resources for K-12 education are not getting to students evenly, exacerbating inequality. I'll talk with a panel of guests about what research shows and what districts can do to improve the situation. Also, comprehensive immigration reform has moved to the back burner for many lawmakers, but today a new national campaign related to high-skilled immigrants is being launched. We'll find out about the project's goals. And Arizona Republic restaurant critic Howard Seftel is retiring after nearly 25 years on the job. I'll talk to him about the changes he's seen in Valley restaurants and how eateries are judged. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House says it's up to negotiators in Switzerland to decide whether to keep Iran nuclear talks going beyond today. However, spokesman Josh Earnest says it won't be open-ended, and he says gaps remain.
While the talks have been productive, we have not yet received the specific tangible commitments that the international community seeks.
Iran and six world powers are trying to agree on a political framework to be used toward a final accord in June. The governor of Arkansas is now asking the legislature to recall or pass a follow-up measure to a religious freedom bill that critics maintain would allow businesses to discriminate against gays and lesbians. He has not specifically called for changes in the legislation to keep it from being used to deny services, but Governor Asa Hutchinson says discrimination was never the intent. It was meant, he says, to keep government from infringing on someone's religious beliefs.
The issue has become divisive because our nation remains split on how to balance the diversity of our culture with the traditions and firmly held religious convictions.
Hutchinson's comments come in the wake of outcry over Indiana's decision to pass similar legislation, which the governor of that state is now asking lawmakers to amend. Indiana is threatened with economic boycotts, and in Arkansas, Walmart has asked Hutchinson to veto the bill. The U.S. is putting hackers on notice. NPR's Arti Shahani reports President Obama has issued the new executive order launching its first sanctions program against cyber criminals.
The White House says it's another tool in the toolbox to target the most serious overseas malicious actors, cyber attackers suspected of threatening critical infrastructure in the U.S. or stealing massive amounts of credit card numbers and healthcare records. Under the new program, federal authorities can name private individuals or government officials and freeze their assets, deny them U.S. visas, and bar their commercial transactions with American businesses. The administration says that should make it much harder to launder money made through cyber attacks, and because foreign banks already comply voluntarily with the U.S. sanctions list, the move should foster some international cooperation. The White House declined to name specific attackers who'd be subject to the sanctions. Arti Shahani, NPR News.
Reports are surfacing that ISIS has infiltrated a Palestinian refugee camp in Damascus, Syria, reaching deeper into the heart of Syria's power base than ever before. The self-proclaimed Islamic State has already carved out large portions of northern Syria and territory in neighboring Iraq as part of its caliphate. At last check on Wall Street, Dow is down 70 points at 17,705. NASDAQ is off 29 at 4872. S&P 500 down 8 at 2,060. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The state of Arizona may be seeing wildfire weather earlier than normal this year. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert reports the strong winds and low humidity that can lead to wildfires are moving in.
National Weather Service meteorologist Jessica Nolte says dry storm systems are usually seen at the beginning of the state's wildfire season.
These dry storm systems that come through that kick up the winds, dry out those grasses and those brushes, and it just takes a spark to maybe get a little bit of a fire going, and then those winds can just whip it and can run with it.
Nolte says motorists need to be aware of how easy it is to spark a fire. She says a cigarette tossed out a vehicle window or a chain dragging from a vehicle and causing a spark are more than enough. Last year's largest fire, the Slide Fire south of Flagstaff, scorched some 21,000 acres of land and cost more than $8 million to put out. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
Arizona leaders say a new road will help revitalize the economy in southern Arizona, focusing on the aerospace and defense industry. Tucson and Pima County are working to realign an access road that will help Raytheon missile systems have a larger buffer from traffic while adding a second runway at Tucson International Airport. Raytheon is the area's largest private employer.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. Shoppers in Phoenix will be paying a little less for their groceries today. At midnight, the city's 1% tax on retail food sales expired. The city council approved a 2% tax in 2010 as the city faced a $277 million budget shortfall. In 2014, lawmakers reduced that to 1%. The tax and its elimination have been controversial since its inception.
We should see sunny skies in the valley today, a high of 91 degrees. More sunshine tomorrow, a little bit cooler, the high dropping to 86.
KJZZ is supported by First Bank on behalf of Arizona Gives Day, a one-day 24-hour online giving campaign that unites Arizonans to support the nonprofit organization of their choice on April 7th. More at azgives.org.
With mostly sunny skies, we have 84 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, many are concerned that resources for K-12 education are not getting to students evenly, exacerbating inequality. I'll talk with a panel of guests about what research shows and what districts can do to improve the situation. Also, comprehensive immigration reform has moved to the back burner for many lawmakers, but today a new national campaign related to high-skilled immigrants is being launched. We'll find out about the project's goals. And Arizona Republic restaurant critic Howard Seftel is hanging up his knife and fork after nearly 25 years on the job. I'll talk to him about the changes he's seen and whether the Valley has become a haven for good food. We start today's program by looking more closely at what's happening at the state capitol. Governor Doug Ducey vetoed bills, including one that would have kept private for 60 days the identities of police officers involved in shootings. He also signed controversial abortion-related legislation. Some legislative leaders had hoped to finish the current session by the end of this week, though that may not be possible. With me for a few minutes from his Capitol office is Senator Steve Farley, Assistant Minority Leader. Senator Farley, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So when we talked to you right before the beginning of the session, you had mostly kind things to say about incoming Governor Ducey. What are your thoughts after his first couple months in office?
Well, it's been a massive disappointment for me to see what the governor has done and not done. I did have high hopes that he would be more of a pragmatic moderate, even more so than Jan Brewer, and I never thought that I would be saying I miss Jan Brewer, but I do. This budget is disastrous for education. It slashed our K-12 schools by $352.4 million. It eliminated and zeroed out community colleges, and it cut another $100 million from our universities, while at the same time spending more on private prisons and fostering more tax cuts. I think this is a really bad idea for Arizona. What was really spooky to me was the governor spun this budget by saying it actually increased money for education, which is Orwellian in its scope. I mean, not since 1984 have we seen such an example of newspeak. If you're going to cut education, admit it. Don't cut it and say you didn't. And I think that's basically a cynical move to try to get people who aren't paying very close attention to the news to somehow think that he increased education when he actually cut it. That's disappointing, because we should all be working together to try to invest in Arizona, not defund Arizona on things that need help.
Well, so what do you think the advantages are to him then to spin something like that when coming in as governor? Even with our legislative system, it seems like he has the bully pulpit to take it in a direction he wants to go.
He does, but I'm not clear he's using it. To me, it seems like that he's surrounded himself with his staff, with a bunch of people from very conservative think tanks like the Goldwater Institute, like the Center for Arizona Policy, and he's letting them call the shots. And I think as governor, he's going to need to stand up. He didn't have a single veto until this week on Monday. I was encouraged when he came out and vetoed the bill that would have let agricultural animals, farm animals, out of the Animal Cruelty Act. So that was a good thing, and he is starting to show some independence from the legislature, which is good, because until then it looked like that Andy Biggs and the Goldwater Institute staffers were going to be running the entire show in the state of Arizona, and I don't think that's what people voted for when they voted for him for governor.
And Senator Farley, you mentioned the Center for Arizona Policy. So what does Governor Ducey signing the abortion-related legislation tell you about who he intends his allies to be? Because during the campaign, at least he gave Kathy Herod and the Center for Arizona Policy a little bit of a long arm. He didn't really want them quite next to him, at least not in obvious ways.
But now that he's in office, I think he's going back together and helping his friends. That abortion bill in particular was really repellent because it includes a requirement that the state posts on the Department of Health Services website, basically junk science. One quack doctor says that you can reverse the effects of a pill-induced abortion if you take the first pill and don't take the second, and you ingest a whole lot of progesterone. That is completely false, and it's been disproven by a bunch of studies, and also shows that if the fetus survives for through birth, there's a much greater chance of huge birth defects, and that's something we're going to say on the state website. It's pretty outrageous that way, and it definitely shows that there's more attention to ideology and keeping Kathy Herod happy than actually paying attention to the facts, and that's immensely disappointing. I think we need to get much more back to a fact-based legislature rather than a faith-based legislature.
Yeah, I was struck by Governor Ducey's reaction when a lot of people were sort of saying, boy, this budget really got rushed through, and his feeling. He made a comment along the lines of, boy, 7 weeks, that doesn't seem like quick to me at all. Is there a feeling that he's sort of still getting his legs as it relates to the legislature, or is he just sort of antsy about those things? Let's get that out of the way so I can start recruiting businesses here.
Well, I loved how he said that, what are they talking about? I've been talking about this budget the entire campaign trail. When you talk to most reporters, and they'll agree that he was vague on everything. He didn't really make any commitments whatsoever. And it's turning out now that one of the reasons that budget may have been rushed through was in order to cut more than we needed to. Because next week in the Financial Advisory Committee, the state's top economists will say that we've actually done much better than we thought, and the deficit is much lower than they thought. So he would not have had to cut as much if this has happened. But I think the agenda of some of the folks, again, in the governor's staff, I'm not sure what the governor's agenda is, but his staff's agenda, together with the agendas of the speaker and the president, has been to cut as much as possible. And having a deeper deficit gave them the excuse to do that.
As we said, the budget got done much earlier this session than usual. So what did that mean for Democrats? Were you pushed aside even more than usual to some extent?
I'm not as concerned about what it did for Democrats, but what it did for the public. Okay. The public did not actually have the opportunity to comment on this budget, and when they did, we saw a whole bunch of parents and teachers and students out in force here at the Capitol saying, you cannot slash our education because we won't have a future. It got rammed through at the last minute. It was in and out in 3 days. We did our main budget debate in the middle of the night, literally, getting out at 6 in the morning. And in Appropriations Committee, the one place where the public could actually comment, the chair was limiting comment to 3 minutes per speaker and three people in favor and three against. The problem was, on the main feed bill, there was only one person from the Goldwater Institute signed in favor of the budget, and 59 people signed in against. So that didn't provide a lot of opportunity for the public to make their concerns clear. And there were a lot of amendments that happened on the floor that even the Republicans who voted for it didn't understand, because they were thrown out at the last minute in order to do deals with people. And while we're at that, the governor keeps calling it a bipartisan budget. There was only one Democrat who voted with the Republicans, Senator Carlisle Begay of the Navajo Nation, who did it in exchange for about a mile's worth of repaving in his district. That doesn't count to me as bipartisan, particularly because you saw three to four different Republicans, depending on the bill, voting against the budget along with Democrats.
Senator Farley, finally, I understand what you say about this being about the public and not about Democrats, but I need to come back to that, though, this idea that if you don't have a voice on that side of the aisle, at least a voice that's not being listened to, what is the other way to get? Are you going to have to get more public support? Are you going to have to get more grassroots, in the sense that when Republicans or when the governor hear these protests about budget cuts or university cuts, they actually listen?
Well, we're just going to have to get more votes and make that happen. And we have been able to flex our muscles on the floor. This past week, we were able to successfully kill the Guns in Public Buildings bill. that would have forced guns into every public building, including courthouses and child protective hearings and stadiums and libraries, city council chambers. And that with that one, we were able to kill on the floor in a coalition with moderate Republicans and all the Democrats. So we're going to continue to stand up and flex our muscle that way. And we're going to talk to the public, and we're going to make very, very clear this is not the way that the government ought to be doing things. I mean, this compounds the problem we have in which the House Speaker has been refusing to assign or hear any Senate Democratic bills, and we've had none come out so far this session, which is a record. He actually had his public information officer say that he would only advance to the floor bills that advance the Republican agenda. Mm. And again, I don't think that's what people voted for when they voted for these folks. The people of Arizona would love to have a government in which we all work together to solve our problems. Put aside the partisan stuff. Let's fix our schools, fix our roads, and fix our economy. And that's something that I think we're going to have to focus on as we lead up to the 2016 campaign. It's time for people to make different choices, because the current choices they've been making in terms of a Republican majority just aren't working for any of us.
State Senator Steve Farley is the Assistant Minority Leader. Steve, thank you.
Thank you for having me on. Really appreciate it.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Now for another perspective on the current legislative session, I'm joined by Bob Robb, Arizona Republic columnist. Bob, good morning.
Good to be with you.
So, Bob, does the public want the sides to work together, or do they want middle-of-the-road Republicans to work with each other?
Well, certainly you'll hear everybody say they want everybody to work together, and you'll hear both parties say that they are pledged to bipartisanship. But the public continues to elect embattled partisans, and the Democratic process by which they went into cahoots with Governor Brewer to seize control of the appropriations process very shortly ago. It wasn't exactly an open and democratic process. So I think the desire for an open and democratic process is proportional to whether you're inside or outside the door, at least at the legislature.
What have you learned in the first couple of months about Doug Ducey in office? Have you been surprised? Are you seeing things that give you promise as he gets more comfortable in the chair?
No, in fact, exactly the opposite. Hmm. There has been a, I think, worrisome tendency by the governor to short-circuit what ought to be the democratic process of vetting legislation. I don't disagree with Senator Farley in terms of the critique of the way the process has occurred. I just dispute the notion that if he was on the other side, he would operate dramatically differently. Now, this may be just a matter of having just taken over the job and having a lot of big stuff that he had to do in a short period of time, and it may not be a long-term trend or tendency. But on the budget, on his wait list proposal, on the inspector general proposal, you have seen last-minute proposals, not vetted, that he tries to cram through. Mm. I think that's a troublesome trend.
What do you think the motivation is for that, Bob, considering he was elected comfortably, the fact that he has Republican majorities? And granted, even though someone like Senate President Andy Biggs has been in office for a while and is flexing his muscles as well, it does seem like, at least to the general public, that a governor would be able to use a bully pulpit if he wanted to.
I'm hopeful it's just the tyranny of time. The governor made a surprising decision to me. I figured that he would initially offer a placeholder budget and then take some time to learn more about the policy choices before he actually landed someplace on the budget. Instead, and to his credit, he spent the interim between his election and his inauguration doing the hard work on the budget, and he produced within a week in office a detailed, complete budget proposal, which he was willing to own. So I'm hoping that it's simply the tyranny of time. He inherited a billion-plus deficit. He didn't have a lot of time to ramp up. He was a little slow in staffing his administration, and he probably wanted something out of the session other than just the budget pain that he knew he had to inflict. So my hope is that it's just the tyranny of time and the shortness in which he's been in office and doesn't represent a pattern of the way that he is going to approach public policy by trying to jam it through with little time for review or input. But so far it has been a trend that bothers me.
Bob, one final question, and I know I ask this as someone who's a member of the media, used to have Governor Napolitano on quite frequently. Does it matter to the public, do you think, and is it important to have a governor who is out there talking more publicly about his priorities, talking more comfortably, even off the cuff occasionally, something that Governor Brewer didn't do, and looks like Governor Ducey's not comfortable with that quite yet. Do you think it's important to have someone like that who wants to give his own message and give it in a way that doesn't sound like it was written for him?
It certainly instills a greater degree of public confidence and gives you a greater opportunity to try to influence public opinion, which in turn influences policy. So a public figure who gives that up does give up a degree of influence. But on the campaign trail, Ducey was extremely message disciplined. He has been that way as governor. Now, my own sense is that he's still sort of feeling his way around the office. He's still relatively new to politics. He's only had two statewide elections, only one of which achieved a great deal of public attention. So he's not been in the public eye a great deal. My anticipation is that as he gets more comfortable in the role in the office, you will see him being more accessible and less so lockstep on a particular message and with the message discipline that he's shown so far.
Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb, you can read his column today as well as Fridays and Sundays. Bob, thank you as always.
Good to be with you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about educational inequity in Arizona. We'll also talk to retiring Arizona Republic restaurant critic Howard Seftel, leaving the knife and fork at the table after more than 20 years. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Opera, performing The Daughter of the Regiment. This comedy follows Marie, a feisty young girl raised by a regiment of French soldiers high in the Alps, April 10th through 12th at Symphony Hall, azopera.org.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour, and then It's the World at 2. A partly to mostly sunny day across the state today. Right now, it's 61 degrees in Flagstaff, 82 in Casa Grande, 82 in Tucson, and 83 in Yuma. Thanks to all of our members who made the spring member drive a success. We heard from over 1,900 new and sustaining members. Your support makes possible the high-quality public service you expect. If you didn't have the opportunity to make your gift of support, you can still do so at kjzz.org, and thank you. It's 84 degrees in Phoenix at 1123.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Momentum for comprehensive immigration reform has slowed to barely a crawl in Congress, as a majority of members want the focus to remain on border security. But a number of business leaders and groups around the country are saying the economic benefits of immigration can be so great that steps have to be taken. Today, a new immigration reform campaign is getting started to bring attention to the need for more visas for highly skilled workers. With me now for a few minutes to talk about that is John Feinblatt, chair of the Partnership for a New American Economy. Mr. Feinblatt, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So give us some of the specifics of the campaign you've kicked off today, this hashtag Let PJ Stay.
Well, you know, PJ's story is a story that you see all across America. He is a Belgium entrepreneur who came to Stanford Graduate School of Business. He ended up, while a student, creating a company called Echo Labs, which is developing a bracelet device for elite athletes that can customize their workouts using the data it collects. And the problem is that PJ is one of many H-1B applicants who's crossing his fingers today. You know, we usually think of April Fool's Day as a day for pranks and jokes, but for people like PJ, this is a very serious day because today is the opening bell for H-1B applicants. And if past history predicts the future, we know that within the next 5 days or so, those visas will be exhausted, and people like PJ are risking being deported, and that matters in two ways. It matters because PJ has started a company here, and people who are working in that company depend on him, but it also matters because it matters to American workers, because PJ's company is employing American workers, and we know from our research that for every H-1B visa that's granted, over the next 7 years, it will create nearly 2 American jobs.
And what's the current situation for H-1B visas? How many are available, and how many do you think ideally should be available?
Well, look, there have been about 85,000 available, and the problem is that that number is just stuck and hasn't changed for years. The problem is that, you know, we have a immigration system that is decades old, and it isn't attuned to the, you know, iPhone age that we now live in. And the truth is that we should be doing what other countries are doing, what our competitors are doing, and trying to have the cap responsive to the needs of the economy.
Well, so what have you heard from members of Congress who don't favor this?
Well, the good news right now is that there are actually legislation being introduced into Congress. Senator Hatch has a bill that is called I-Squared, which would raise the H-1B cap and set the level at what the economy demands, and that's just good business. We know that our competitors are actually rolling out the red carpet for people like PJ, and we're shooting ourselves in the foot by not actually welcoming PJ and the people like him. You know, and this isn't just a Silicon Valley story or a New York story. It is a story that is felt in every state. You know, what we just are releasing today is actually a report that goes state by state and shows actually the job creation capacity of H-1B holders. In fact, in Arizona, we know that H-1B workers will create more than 6,000 American jobs by 2020. And that's the case all across the country. Sometimes people just sort of think of this as, you know, a high-tech issue that is a Silicon Valley issue or a New York City issue, but it's not. Places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia will see more than 15,000 new jobs created because of H-1B workers. And we need those jobs. Those are people who we should embrace and welcome, not deport and send back to countries who are now our competitors.
John Feinblatt is chair of the Partnership for a New American Economy. He's been talking with us about a new immigration reform campaign that got started today called Hashtag Let PJ Stay. John, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much, Steve.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Beginning 1 week from today, the Arizona School Boards Association will be hosting a 3-day conference in Phoenix called the Equity Event, Leadership Strategies and Promising Practices for Closing the Opportunity and Achievement Gaps. Sessions will include topics like collaborating to create preschool to post-secondary opportunities for student success, and why all districts should examine data through an equity lens. Joining me to talk about striving toward educational equity in Arizona are Tracy Benson, Assistant Executive Director of the Arizona School Boards Association. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Also here is Dr. Kent Scribner, superintendent of the Phoenix Union High School District. Dr. Scribner, thank you for being here as well.
Good to be here, Steve. Thank you.
Well, let's start off with the concept. And Dr. Scribner, let me start with you on this. What's the origin of educational inequity? Because people, I think, are aware of the concept, but why does it seem to keep going on, almost cyclical?
Well, as a policy matter, the concept of equity is complicated because it's a matter of redressing rather than addressing, identifying some inequity that has shown to be serious and need of remedy. With regard to education, the best predictor of educational success, unfortunately, is socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. And serving a student population that is low income and language minority we really must re-examine how we are spending our resources and investing in our students as the assets that they are.
Do you think there's an inherent unfairness in the system that people are conscious of that sort of keeps going on, or is there, I don't want to say conspiracy, is there a feeling that people just aren't working hard enough to fix it?
No, I think a couple things. I think as a state, Arizona needs to take a look at its priorities and determine whether or not we view education and our students as the assets that they are, as opposed to problems that need to be solved. The link between education and the economy is inextricable and well documented. And what this effort attempts to do is call to action the focus on our student population, 135,000 students in the Phoenix urban core, most of them low income and many of them language minority, and take a look at where these students will be in the next decades, where will our city, where our state will be if we do not address this issue today.
Tracy Benson, this conference is an exciting idea. You're bringing together so many different people. It seems like a pioneering idea. How difficult was it to put it together?
Well, it wasn't difficult to put it together simply because there are so many organizations in Arizona that are working around this issue. We're partnering with the Helios Education Foundation, which has made this a priority for many years now, and WestEd, and the United Way is part of this. What is unique about it, really, is that we're bringing the topic to the forefront as the primary conversation starter at this event, and really bringing school leaders in on it, governing board members, superintendents, principals, in collaboration with these other organizations that are already invested in it, and saying, let's really put this on the table, unwrap it, talk about it, find out what we can do as leaders together around this issue to make sure that all students have what they need to succeed.
That's Tracy Benson. She's Assistant Executive Director of the Arizona School Boards Association. Now joining us by phone is Jeannie Powers, Associate Professor of Educational Policy and Evaluation at ASU's Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College. Jeannie, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what were some of the key things that you've studied, the measurements by the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights? And I also want to hear about your newer research related to how schools are becoming more segregated.
So I'm going to focus on the civil rights data collection analysis.
Okay.
So this is work that I'm doing with PhD students in the Educational Policy and Evaluation Program. And our goal was really to explore the distribution of key resources in Arizona's public schools. So we examined four key areas, access to early childhood education, high-quality teachers, gifted and talented programs, and experiences associated with college readiness.
Okay. And what have you seen? Where does Arizona compare with other states? Are we doing worse?
Well, we didn't really want to look at other states per se. What we really wanted to do was kind of just look in general at how our state is doing. And to get back to your question about segregation, mm-hmm. I think this is really important to examine because there has been a substantial demographic shift in Arizona over the past two decades. So you might remember that the demographic shift in public schools made national headlines last fall. So it was widely reported that public schools nationwide are now majority minority. Arizona hit that milestone a few years ago. So statewide, the two largest demographic groups are Latino and white students, who are roughly evenly represented in Arizona's public schools.
So, Kent, when we get to a point where people are at the high school level, I imagine at that point it can be pretty hard to turn things around. So you must be extremely interested in getting these things fixed at as early an age as possible to make sure that we're not having kids who have had 8 years of inequity as they enter high school.
Absolutely. And that's why we're working so closely, not only with the School Boards Association, but also with the United Way and an initiative called Thriving Together. It's a cross-sector collaboration of educators, business leaders, nonprofit, philanthropic leaders, and faith-based organizations to look not only at the 135,000 students in the K-12 pipeline, but the 250,000 students within our boundaries from birth to young adulthood. Again, what happens with multiple well-meaning social service agencies and all of the institutions, if there are 187 different initiatives, then there really are none. We want to distill those down and selectively abandon those practices that are not effective and focus on a few things. As Jeannie indicated, early childhood, access to high-quality early childhood education, third-grade reading proficiency, eighth-grade math, hold me accountable for four-year graduation rate in high school, college career preparedness, and then the universities, not only for post-secondary access, but post-secondary success. Again, our students are representative of the demographic profile of the city of Phoenix in a decade, and Phoenix has historically been representative of the state of Arizona in another decade. So what we're doing right now really is going to affect the future of our city and our state.
Tracy, certainly education standards have been in the news a lot lately when it comes to achievement tests and how Arizona should measure itself within the state against other states. Are we in a position where, because of the way we're trying to figure things out, is there enough attention being paid to the fact that we do have the demographic shifts? Is enough attention being paid to that as we decide what achievement is and how Arizona lines up?
Well, I think we need to set the bar high for all our students. And we've seen great examples of successes right here in the Phoenix area. For example, the Osborne Elementary School District has had tremendous success with a high minority, low-income student population and really implementing those standards early and then having great successes with all of their schools earning A's and B's on the state accountability report card. So we know students can perform if given the right supports, and there's an example of a district that's pursuing equity and giving those kids the opportunity they need and those kids absolutely stepping up and meeting the challenge.
And a word that comes to mind a lot is perception, and this idea that how much does perception then create reality? Is that part of what you're saying, this idea that we can't just presume that if it's a low-income area, they're not going to be able to achieve?
The fact of the matter is, the way we've looked at achievement gaps in the past have had to do with race and ethnicity and income. And as Dr. Powers and Dr. Scribner both mentioned, the majority of students in Arizona now are in those groups that we have looked at the achievement gap related to, the Hispanic population, Native American population, low-income population. Those are our students. Those are the majority of our students. So when we're making decisions and talking about the achievement gap, we're talking about an issue that's affecting the majority of our students. So we really have to make those big decisions on their behalf.
Okay. Can't go ahead.
Yeah, and when you're talking about the Latino population in Phoenix, that's not a subgroup.
Right.
It's 84% of our population. And I think urban schools historically have made the mistake of approaching low-income students from a deficit perspective, deficit model. How do we minimize their failure? I'm not interested in minimizing student failure. I'm interested in equity and excellence in equal parts.
Jeannie, do you have anything to add on that based on research you've done?
Well, so what we found, well, we looked statewide as part of the conversation starter that Tracy was talking about, and so we're just trying to kind of give a snapshot of what we look like across the state rather than focus on specific districts. And so we found, for example, that access to early childhood education in school-based programs is very limited across the states. So, for example, a few charter schools offer pre-K programs, and about 400 schools in elementary and unified districts serve about 20,000 students. Now, given the number of schools, students in that age group, and also given the amount of students that are attending other types of programs, that's pretty limited. And so the numbers fall far short of the estimates of the kids both enrolled in pre-K programs and a fraction of the kids in that age group. And so that's what we wanted to think about, is kind of where are we as a state doing on resource issues, because I think we still do have to pay attention to resource issues, because if we want kids to achieve, we have to make sure that all kids are attending high-quality schools.
Kent, do kids of low economic background, perhaps an ethnic background, Latino or otherwise, do they have enough good, obvious examples to follow? Not that there aren't great examples, but do they know about those good examples?
I mean, I think so. And I think in Phoenix Union, we really strive to hire individuals who have cultural competence. Mm. I don't want diversity without quality, but I don't want quality without diversity. Well, again, that needs to be balanced. And I think, again, from the paradigm shift, the different multiple perspective approach, I look at our students not as disadvantaged. Our Fortune 500 companies are looking for what? Bilingual, bicultural, resilient, collaborative employees. I've got 27,000 of those in Phoenix Union. There's 135,000 in the pipeline.
But do you feel like your district, Phoenix Union, everyone knows Phoenix Union High School District, but do you think it gets enough attention, it gets enough respect from the leaders of the state and the area?
I think that the state in general needs to understand that the population in our schools will be the workforce and the leaders in decades to come. I also believe that folks need to look at our students as assets to be invested in and not problems that need to be solved. And the whole Latinization of Arizona is a big issue that many of our leaders perhaps either don't recognize or choose not to.
Tracy, just a couple of minutes left, but I want to bring this back to educational equity, obviously the conference going on next Wednesday through Friday. Is this an issue, regardless of politics or party or whatnot, is this an issue that leaders like the state superintendent, like folks on the State Board of Education, do you think actively think about when they start making decisions?
I think increasingly so, because it is an issue and a topic that's inescapable as our population changes. Could we do more to look at it and acknowledge it and put more resources towards the supports that are needed to provide that equitable programming? Yes, I think so. When we had the big debate at the legislature this year about dollars in the classroom versus student support services, so many of those important items that have to do with providing that equitable foundation or opportunities for students come from those dollars outside of the classroom, those additional support services. So the conversation necessarily has to shift, I think, rather than focusing on that equality and everybody gets the same dollars in the classroom. We talk about what's equitable and what do kids need to thrive and to succeed.
Ken, less than a minute or so. What about that leadership question?
Absolutely. It does require more resources to educate some students. And again, if folks could really recognize the importance and the inextricable link between our education and the economy, states that have the highest per capita income, Massachusetts, also invest at the highest level for education. Mm-hmm. Arizona could follow that trend very, very easily by recognizing education as an investment and not a cost.
Dr. Kent Scribner is superintendent of the Phoenix Union High School District. Also here, Tracy Benson, assistant executive director of the Arizona School Boards Association. And joining us by phone, Jeannie Powers, associate professor of educational policy and evaluation at ASU's Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out about Howard Saftel as he retires as restaurant critic for the Arizona Republic. What will he do next, and will he get hungry? Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners, specialty meats, fine wines, and desserts for spring celebrations. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and kjzz.org. We'll see sunny skies in the valley today, a high near 91 degrees. Join us at 12 o'clock for Here and Now from Boston. Today, Arkansas's governor will announce whether he'll sign a religious freedom bill similar to Indiana's new law. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies right now, and it's 84 degrees at 11:43.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Arizona Diamondbacks are coming off a terrible year, one that began with the team's best starting pitcher getting hurt right before a season-opening trip to Australia. So what's changed as the 2015 season is only a few days away from starting? I'm joined by Zach Buchanan, who covers the Diamondbacks for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Zach, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks
for
having me.
Yeah, well, let's think about some of the players that have been added. I know you and Nick Pecoro in the Republic have written a lot about Yasmani Tomas. Is he going to be a third baseman? Is he going to be an outfielder? Is he going to even make the team? What have you seen from him so far?
Well, the third base experiment, to put it gently, has been a work in progress. But so far, I don't think they've given any indication that they see him playing anywhere else, at least for the near future. He's played most of his games in spring at third. He hasn't played much of the outfield, which is where they said he would end up if he couldn't handle third. So I think reading the tea leaves, he either ends up in the majors or in the minors, but it's going to be at third base. because, I mean, they've only got a couple of exhibition games left. If they were really thinking about starting him out in the outfield, you'd think they'd give him more reps out there. So he's got a lot of work to do. It may be that they want to put him in the minors so he can play there every day, get regular at-bats, maybe be away from some of the attention that would come from being the big free agent acquisition of the offseason, trying to learn a position that's pretty unfamiliar to him. That's my guess as to what would happen, but he could still end up the third baseman on opening day or maybe even coming off the bench. They've paid lip service to that.
Now, he was given a pretty hefty contract. Was he the biggest signing of the offseason?
He was the biggest signing in Diamondbacks franchise history. So, yeah, they've committed to him $68.5 million.
Hey, you know, it seems funny, and you cover the team every day, but when you have a team that's coming off a tough season, did that seem like something that's really more for the long term? They're thinking this could be a star that comes in a couple of years, and this year maybe their expectations are low, or are they actually saying they think they can compete this year?
They're saying a little bit of both. I think they feel like they can compete for a playoff spot, or they can be above 500, or very early on in the winter, Tony La Russa, the team's chief baseball officer, said he'd be very disappointed if they finished below 500. Well, at the same time, I don't think they're predicting they're going to be world beaters. And certainly the moves they made this offseason don't suggest a team that was ramping up to go for the World Series this year. Signing Osmani Tomas was a big move, but that's when he was available. And if you think this is a guy that's going to hit 30 home runs a year for you, you had to go for him now. But, I mean, the trades they made, they traded away Miguel Montero, they traded away Wade Mott. The return on those trades, they got younger with both of them, with more unpolished players who could pan out in the future, and they added more depth. I definitely think they'll be better this year. I think they'll be better this year. It's hard to lose 64 games. But I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. Maybe they do. They could surprise. They have a pretty strong core of position players. But they're going to be better, but I don't think that they're predicting World Series titles right now.
So, Zach, other than first baseman Paul Goldschmidt, who's going to be a perennial MVP candidate, we would think, at first base, are there any other real strengths that the team has going into the season?
I think the position player core, at least offensively, is pretty good. Mark Trumbo looks phenomenal this spring, and he's going to be in right field where he's looked pretty comfortable. A.J. Pollock, I think, is capable of being one of the best center fielders in the game defensively and maybe even offensively. I mean, he's a pure line drive hitter and had just a monster couple months at the beginning of last season before he got hurt. Chris Owings could end up at second or short. I think he'll produce offensively. He's another guy who had his injury or had his season shortened by injury. And there are some young prospects to like. Jake Lamb has looked really good. Ender Diarte and David Peralta will get time in left field. They've looked great. I think there's a lot to like about the core. And even though he might not start the season in the majors, Archie Bradley, their top pitching prospect, has had a phenomenal spring. It's just light years away from where he was last year when he was really struggling with his command. So I think there's a lot to build on. It's just a question of how much of it comes all together this year.
And, Zach, one last thing. How big a difference and how obvious has the difference been that Chief of Baseball Operations Tony La Russa has had now with his first spring training with the organization going into his first full season running the team?
Well, I think, at least as far as spring training has been concerned, he has been pretty hands-off when it comes to Chip Hale, the manager, and how he runs his spring. I think he said he's been impressed with how organized Chip is about the stuff, that he really hasn't had to step in and say, this is how we're going to do things. For Tony, I think it's more he's building this franchise and into his vision of what a winning baseball team looks like. So any trade they make, any big decision, have got to get his okay, and he wants a certain type of player, certain type of guys, and certain type of people around the organization. So he is just the head baseball mind here who has the overarching vision. But I don't know that – I think he's being pretty careful about not trying to micromanage too much. He feels confident in the people he's brought into this organization. He's going to let them do their jobs.
Zach Buchanan covers the Arizona Diamondbacks for AZ Central and the Arizona Republic. Zach, thanks for squeezing us in this morning.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Valley restaurant scene has changed dramatically over the past quarter century, with an increase in nationally praised chefs and of eaters who appreciate them and their creations. One person who has seen those changes up close and anonymously is Arizona Republic restaurant critic Howard Seftel, who's retiring from the position at the end of this month. Howard, what's changed about your approach over the years, since you're a journalist while also being a critic, and how much pressure is there, knowing you could potentially make or break a restaurant?
The pressure starts when you look at a blank computer screen and the blood starts clotting up between your eyebrows because you're trying to write something. And then you have to pass the sleep test where you don't file your review until you are absolutely sure it is accurate, it's fair, it's right, it's knowledgeable, it's entertaining. And it hasn't happened too often, but the feeling of waking up at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat, thinking you got something wrong, or you didn't quite explain it right, or you might have been unfair or unclear, is the worst feeling a journalist can have. I have two constituencies. I have the reader. Now, the purpose of a restaurant review is to tell somebody out there, this is where you should or should not spend, or how you should spend your hard-earned money. Mm-hmm. So I have to be completely honest about the experience. On the other hand, as you pointed out, when, I don't know, maybe 800,000 people might read something you write, you have to be aware that you're dealing with somebody's profession and livelihood, and you have to restrain yourself from being clever, you know, I put quotation marks around it, or malicious or snide at somebody's expense.
I wonder, when you're in a situation, especially as a food critic or restaurant critic, it's always been this feeling of anonymity. I mean, I can remember when I was a kid, you'd see the photo would be the holding up of the newspaper or the mask or the sunglasses or something like that. How does that affect your approach? And even, let's say, when you're thinking about a column a couple of days hence, did you have an editorial assistant who could call the restaurant and fact check for you? How would you deal with that?
Anonymity is the issue these days, and that this ship has sailed.
Okay.
People, a lot of critics have recently sort of come out, if I can use that word, Jonathan Gold in L.A., Leslie Brenner in Dallas. And what they're trying to do, in my opinion, is to square a circle that cannot be squared. And their point is that, well, chef can't suddenly become a great cook. You suddenly can't do great things. And as long as I don't know you're coming and doing something special, it really doesn't matter. This is BS, if I can say that on the air. This is a rationalization, which I understand. We're living in an age of social media where nobody, not only is nobody anonymous, nobody wants to be anonymous. Everybody wants to be the star of hit. Not only do you want to be the star of your own life, but you now have the technology to be the star of your own life. But the fact is, if you're going to write a restaurant review whose aim is to help readers choose where to eat, that can't happen if you're not anonymous. Now, I'm not saying you can't write an entertaining column, mm-hmm. a knowledgeable column, an interesting column, an insightful column. However, you cannot write a column that's going to help a reader choose where to go to a restaurant. Yeah. I was in a restaurant once with another restaurant critic here in town. The chef knew this other critic, but did not know me. So this critic is sitting there. First, the maitre d's in the Italian suits come over and make sure everything is okay. Then the chef himself jumps out of the kitchen, and I heard this because the critic was only a few tables away, puts a dish in front of her and said, I made 3 veal chops. This is the best one. If you think for a moment that, you know, Joe and Martha from Peoria are going to get remotely the same treatment, it's not going to happen. You know, there are a couple of places, Steve, and it's the first time I'm talking about this, where owners or chefs know who I am, a handful, a very small handful. Mm. And believe me, Most of them, of course, are very classy. You know, they're not going to make a fuss. But I'm waited on by the manager. A dish I didn't order shows up. You might want to try this. And of course, you can let it go to your head. It's very flattering, but you're not, at least to me, that's not the job I want to do.
One thing I've noticed over the years is that when you write, especially about upscale, more expensive restaurants, but you will often comment, well, this is interesting, and of course they had the roast chicken or the salmon for people or such and such. Now, is that something that is typically done in other cities, or is this kind of a Phoenix thing?
It's not done in the top tier cities. Or if it's done, it's done to a much, much lesser extent. If you go to a contemporary restaurant in San Francisco, there's not going to be salmon teriyaki on the menu. Phoenix does not yet have a fine dining cohort that's large enough so that the chefs can confidently say, well, I'm not putting beef short ribs on the menu. I'm not putting salmon teriyaki. I'm not putting roast chicken. Now, they could have a dish that's maybe lower calorie or vegetarian, but is still interesting. But one of the reasons Phoenix is still a second-tier dining town is, and it used to be a fifth-tier dining town. So I want to make that clear that I think, I'm not a booster, but the reality is we're much, much better than we used to be, but we still don't have a fine dining cohort that's large enough for a chef to say, I can ignore. If there's a group of four and one person says, well, I'm not eating octopus, you know, I'm not eating this pork cheek, you must have the steak, you must have the chicken, and you must have the salmon. And believe me, I've talked to enough chefs who go, man, would I like not to do this, because the best chefs are very creative, but you have to earn a living.
Let's talk more about how Phoenix has changed. Certainly, there are more regarded chefs here. There are restaurants that are considered to be more experimental, certainly, than there used to be. And some of these experimental restaurants are actually quite successful.
Yes. There are restaurants here, Steve, that if they were in Paris or New York or San Francisco, would have Michelin stars next to them. Mm. Now, we don't have a whole bunch of them, but we have several, you know, world-class, one-of-a-kind dining destinations.
What has made the difference? It does seem like it's something that's happened more in the last decade.
That's exactly right. And although it's happened the last decade, the foundation for this happened over two decades. And what happened in the 1990s is we had two kinds of immigration. We had lots of Californians coming, and New Yorkers, and people from Washington and Canada, people from elsewhere in the States, sophisticated people who were coming with good jobs and looking to have a nice lifestyle here in the Southwest. So we had this domestic immigration of a cohort that demanded more the kind of food that they used to be able to get at home. Secondly, and less obvious, is we had tons of foreign immigration. I mean, our immigrant community in the 70s and 80s there might have been three or four different ethnic varieties. I did an article a couple of years ago. I think I counted 40 different ethnic cuisines. And what happens is it percolates into the culinary system. And so chefs now, you might not have a Peruvian restaurant, but you might see some Peruvian touches, or you might see a Thai touch. What we've done in the last 20 years, it's kind of like giving birth in 6 months. It's all come really, really fast, maybe too fast for us to, if I can use this word, digest it. Mm-hmm. But we have roared from a cow town where, you know, steak and baked potato was on every menu to a reasonably sophisticated second-tier dining city.
Now that you're no longer the anonymous critic, how often will you and your family go out to eat? Are you someone who likes to go out to eat?
I do like to go out to eat. It's going to be very, very, I mean, weird beyond belief. It's been almost a quarter of a century since I spent my own money at a restaurant. What I've missed for 25 years is to walk into a restaurant and somebody to go, Mr. Seftel or Howard, nice to see you here. Can I get you your favorite bourbon old fashioned? And I will go, yes, indeed. Just sort of have an experience that most diners have.
Like a normal person.
Yeah, boy. I am not a normal person, Steve, at least when it comes to eating out.
Howard Seftel, retiring restaurant critic of the Arizona Republic. Now he's coming down off his pedestal to join the rest of us.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Thanks. Howard Seftel will be roasted and toasted by a number of Valley chefs coming up on April 26th at the Herberger Theater Center in Phoenix. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Bruce Drummond and Jimmy Jenkins for their help, and thank you very much for listening. If you want to catch part of the program again or listen to one of our previous programs, go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org, or you can download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day.